You're listening to I'm Ready for My Close-Up on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and on tonight's show I'm talking to the British director Julian Temple about his new film The Eternity Man, a screen adaptation of the opera by Dorothy Porter and Jonathan Mills. The Eternity Man tells the true story of Arthur Stace, who wandered the streets of Sydney for two generations, writing the word eternity in chalk on a myriad of surfaces, and Temple's film vividly brings to life this modern avatar of the Wandering Jew. I'm also talking to Julian about his other work, from Absolute Beginners to Pandemonium, and his various documentaries made with the Sex Pistols. I'm talking to director Julian Temple, whose new movie, The Eternity Man, is showing tonight at the Barbican. It's a co-production between Australian TV and Channel 4, so presumably this is something that was intended for showing on TV, but it does seem a very cinematic film, so I guess it's nice to actually see it projected.
Yeah, very much so. I think we all conceived of it as an opera film, a movie, an opera movie, rather than a TV show or a filmed opera. So hopefully it has some cinematic qualities that match the kind of stylized nature of opera in itself.
Because it's interesting, the last thing that I saw projected at the Barbican was a live transmission from the Met in New York. So at the moment there does seem to be this dialogue going on between opera and cinema, using the sort of the cinematic screen as a way of exploring opera in a different way to being in the audience of a live performance.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really challenging, interesting area. I mean, it's not the easiest thing to work with actors, or opera singers as actors, because they're trained to hit the back row at the Scala with very large, over-the-top gestures, you know. So bringing them down to the level of a cinematic close-up where, you know, even just the twitch of an eye is telling you a lot of things about someone is quite difficult. I think that was probably our biggest challenge in making this film, was to find someone. And initially we were looking the other way around, seeing if we could find an actor who could sing, who could be trained to actually master the technique of singing some of these arias. And we had some very good actors interested who were keen to do it. When they understood the size of that task, they didn't have the time to devote to it. So we started, you know, exploring the other way as well, and were really lucky to find Grant, who seemed to be able to, you know, whisper the arias at time and make them powerful and sing them running upstairs. We were very keen, in a sense, to have the truth of recording the singers there and then in the streets, rather than laying over a studio performance. Because I think the feeling that an actor has as he's within a scene is very different from a singer standing on stage. And the atmospheres of the city around him and so on, I think, added to the kind of mystery of doing it in a way. You know, I wouldn't have liked to fake that. It was quite an important part of the project to make sure we recorded it with some flaws, you know, because it's obviously not a perfect way to sing an aria when you're running upstairs, but it ties the voice into the dramatic meaning of the scene, you know.
Well, it does seem very interesting in the film, the tension between artificiality, for example, when you're representing the passing of time by projecting cinema footage onto walls that the Eternity Man is walking past, and then the truth in the acting and the singing. Was that something that you thought of when you first conceived of turning the opera into a film?
Not really. You know, I did a lot of nocturnal walks in Sydney with a local historian, or a guy who specialised in the kind of history of the underbelly of Sydney, which is something I just had a vision of the Sydney Harbour and the glittering skyscrapers and a kind of beach. That was my version of Sydney. So it was quite a revelation to walk through these kind of layers of time with this guy and see elements of the older Sydneys that still exist in corners. And it became, you know, certainly became clear it would be great to use the city at night as a kind of stage. And then, you know, weighing up the budget that we had and, you know, recreating the 1940s with lots of extras and costumes and lots of cars and so on seemed actually quite impossible, and perhaps a waste of money to try and spend it on that, where you could kind of summon up the ghosts of the city with archive, which I have been using quite a lot in documentary films that I've done recently, and I've become very fascinated about how you can breathe a new kind of life into archive images. So having these ghosts kind of playing on the walls as he walked through seemed, you know, quite operatic in a sense, but also quite a powerful thing, finding these parts of the city where these things still seem alive, and having these flickering shadows from other times enveloping him seemed powerful, and obviously more affordable. You know, with a small projector you can move around at night with a small van, and we were quite mobile, and thought you were kind of communing with the past in a way, in an interesting way.
Well, it's interesting what you were saying about opera singers being used to projecting to the back of the hall and then having to learn the craft again in a way for cinema, because your film covers like 100 years of Australian history and Australian cinema, and the kind of acting that you got in silent cinema in a way was the same kind of gestures, projecting to the back of the crowd, and then actors had to learn how to act in talkies. So in a way you're commenting on that as well.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, in a way it is a silent movie, with the Aries providing a kind of interior monologue. I mean, there's not a lot of dialogue or interaction between characters. I mean, there are moments when that happens, but, you know, for a large part of the film it's one man's journey through time, really. And the film becomes a meditation on the passing of time, and very much Sydney through time, but I think many big cities have undergone a similar journey to this 21st century Orwellian meta space that seems to rise up and, you know, have an identity crisis, and what city used to be is no longer really there. So I did find that the Aries worked not as a dramatic thing in the end, but as a kind of meditation on that man's journey through, quite an alienating journey through a century that he felt very, very apart from. But in his, you know, living it by night with this obsessive recurrent ritual of writing the word, he seemed quite a fixed, blank, almost like a good mirror to travel through and play the old archive film and show the city as it developed, you know.
I read that in reality he only did that for, I think, 35 years, but in your film it looks like the best part of a century. Was that something that was already in the opera, or did you decide to extend that span in order to give it this sense of history?
We did decide. Oh, I mean, in a sense, he still walks the streets of Sydney. You certainly still see the word eternity written in chalk on the streets. People carry that on, and you know, the thing at the end of the film where his word is up in the fireworks across the Harbour Bridge for the millennium, he's very emblematic of Sydney. Again, I think quite a lot of cities have these strange, primitive, eccentric characters that somehow they adopt as an emblem, and certainly space is one of those in terms of Sydney. And I do find there is something conceptual about him. Obviously, he's not Banksy, he's a million miles away from Banksy, but he was doing graffiti in the street, and he had this kind of conceptual thing of writing in the word eternity in chalk, and the next rain storm would wash it away, or the rush hour feet would wear it away. So in a way it is a kind of art piece that he stumbled upon. I mean, all those things were fascinating about the story for me.
I don't know how many musicals and operas have been committed to film in Australia, but the few that I have seen, Moulin Rouge, obviously, The Return of Captain Invincible, which I think was made in the early 80s, they all do actually seem to deal with the collision. Of course, yeah, Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. They all seem to deal with the collision of cultures from different decades. I mean, I don't know if that's a particularly Australian approach to musicals, or it's just something to do with the landscape.
Well, maybe on one level they don't have that many decades to
yes.
choose from, but, you know, it is a strange dichotomy between this incredibly ancient piece of land with the whole Aboriginal culture stretching away into the distant, distant past, and the sense of a very new, young country that's still trying to find an identity, and the one that it was given by the British Empire is certainly has undergone kind of radical transformation, and it, you know, it's an exciting place. And far more cultured place than we often, I think, in Britain are led to believe it might be. You know, I found the people that I met there and the food that I ate there, you know, was extraordinary, really. It was quite bizarre to around the other kind of... There is an Englishness about it as well. Obviously, it's cut with a lot of other things, particularly the Asian thing now, but also kind of American thing. Yeah, it's a great culture. Partly, I think maybe it's youth, you know, allows you to see things slightly more clearly. I think as an outsider, you know, I did things that they would never dream of doing, you know, anything as stupid as showing the Harbour Bridge in a film. You know, we don't do that. That's too obvious. But I, as someone who stood there and looked at it, and it's so much part of Sydney, and the building of it was so much part of how Sydney overcame a really very bad depression that the whole world suffered, but it was particularly bad in Sydney, and the bridge was a kind of symbol of rising over that and so on. That it was quite a central thing to this span of time that we were looking at either side of, you know. So I'm sure an Australian would have other benefits to bring to, you know, advantages that they'd have in making a film like this, but there is something of looking from outside at Australia that's quite good, I think.
Do you find making films in different locations that the place where you're making the film suggests a certain aesthetic, a certain feel? Because something like Absolute Beginners very much feels like a London-based film. Something like Earth Girls Are Easy seems to have that brightly coloured kitsch feel that you might expect LA to have. Is that something you think about? Or
making films about specific cultures and trying to relate, you know, the characters to a story which enlightens you, not just about them, but about the world that's created them. And I find that a thing that cinema can do, probably better than most forms, because you're actually showing these places around the characters. It's not kind of sets that are reducing it or words that are metaphors for it. It's actually using the place as a thing to paint with, in a way, and it's very exciting to me. And I love, you know, the kind of historical, social aspects, cultural evolution of places are something I'm really interested in. So I tend to do that too much, but I do it. And I was fascinated by Sydney. I think you've got to push and push to, you know, because I knew nothing about it. But if you immerse yourself in it, you can start beginning to understand it in one way. I mean, it's obviously your way, and it's not everyone's way, but you can start feeling when you are, I don't know what the word would be, but communing with it, you know, feeling when you're walking, you're hearing your footsteps in the empty street, you seem to be able to have a sense of what happened there 50 years ago, or the psyche of a place starts suggesting itself to you, which is great, you know. I mean, it's great thing about making films is you have the ability to really immerse yourself and learn about something you know nothing about, you know, in a way.
Your last two dramatic films have been based on either poets or the work of poets. Is this a recent interest of yours, or is a subject you'd been meaning to deal with for a while?
No, I've always been really, really powerfully connected to poetry as a way of seeing things. I mean, Coleridge was someone I was involved with, and as a kid my parents would drag me where he walked, and I hated it at the time, but at school I found I liked him, that he was someone I could connect to. So it's a long-standing thing with the Coleridge thing. This was exciting because I think Dorothy, who is really sad that she has died, you know, which is quite hard to believe because she was so alive, you know, and so passionate about this project. But her poetry was another big plus for me, to reason to get involved, you know. I mean, it took the kind of slang and the rawness of Australian, you know, argo, and made this very visceral kind of poetry, and very spiritual poetry at times, out of it. And that was another challenge with the singer, with Grant, was to get him to try and sing particularly the early parts of the opera in Australian, which, you know, they have drummed out of them as Australians. If you want to be an opera singer, you have to sing RP, kind of English. And the vowels don't really fit, you know. So I think he really enjoyed that, but it was quite hard for him to kind of undo a lot of that subliminal training that he had, and it was great to have an opera sung, you know, partly in thick Australian, you know. It's great, and you don't really put those things together normally, you know, Australian and Australian accent and opera, you know.
Well, I mean, even the work of Dorothy's, I hadn't come across it until recently. I mean, I interviewed the graphic novelist Eddie Campbell recently, and he said that he's working on an adaptation of some of her work. So it almost seems that as far as the UK is concerned, we're just becoming aware of her work, as unfortunately she's just no longer around.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I, in a selfish way, I think that's really good that people are, are going to enjoy her work probably more now than they have done before. But it was a right out of the blue for me, and it was very, very odd because, she was so engaged in, I didn't work with her on the original libretto, but then I wrote a screenplay that suggested more scenes, and then we did work together in creating these new scenes for it. And she was just so engaged and inventive and enthusiastic about it that she was an astonishing person to work with. So I hope people do learn more about her. I mean, I haven't read everything that she's done, but there are some amazing other long poems, that are very dramatic in construction, interesting. So the comic graphic novel sounds really good.
And both in The Eternity Man and Pandemonium, you have the work of the poet. I mean, in Pandemonium, literally the poet himself visiting the modern age. I suppose it's because these words have a certain resonance in our souls that just become relevant from one generation to the next.
Yeah, I think great poets like Coleridge have the ability to be reinvented through time to become relevant to different ages. I also find the fact that someone like me was obsessed enough to make a film about him, in a way he still is alive. If people are talking about him, and every year where I live you see these strange Coleridgians, from Tokyo on the hills where he used to walk, or Paris or America, converging. He is alive, and a lot of the things that drove those romantic poets, the kind of reassessment of nature and, kind of man's contract with nature in a way, are very relevant now, I like the idea that people, I'm not saying they physically inhabit places of ghosts, but certainly when you're thinking about their ideas and their words, they are alive in a way, And, I have made films that try and explore that area. I would like to do one about Marlowe, actually. Someone else I was interested in. But also a great story,
Thinking of the mix between reality and artificiality in some of your films, do you think that's something that's inherent in musicals as a genre? Because obviously you've done it in The Eternity Man, and something like Absolute Beginners, going between the streets of Soho and then, say, the giant typewriter. And then you get other people's films, like, say, An American in Paris, where you have the scenes shot in contemporary Paris, and then you have the exaggerated dream sequences. Is it because the audience have to make this kind of leap of faith that they're watching a musical, but they're still seeing actors performing an ordinary script, that there is this sort of juxtaposition between what we're used to and an exaggerated version of the truth?
Well, it's a certain, both a musical and an opera are a certain stylized version of cinema, and I think with a musical, what attracted me to musicals in the cinema is that it's almost an abstract kind of filmmaking where the spectacle, the movement of the dancers or the colors just traveling across the screen, certainly transcend a narrative. You're freed from the narrative at that moment, and you can explore other ways of feeling emotions, which I really like. And I think opera obviously has that similar thing built into it. You're then bringing another, film. I mean, opera already has that as a form, and then you're bringing cinema to bear on that, so it's a kind of double stylization. This is certainly a different kind of cinema than you would make based on contemporary London story. It seemed to me that the operatic dimension of it required, also liberated you to have internal you know, ideas explore what's going on deep inside someone. You know, the arias seem to illustrate that and encourage that. You know, I'm wary of over-stylization in other contexts. I don't think it's necessary, you know, a kind of universal way of doing things. But, you know, half the time you spend in your head, you know, dreaming about something that's not actually happening in reality around you. So I think it's certainly a good thing to try and get to grips with as well. Anyway.
Well, I think it's interesting that when you talk about the filmmaking process, you use a lot of the vocabulary that I would expect a fine artist to use when they're perhaps talking about painting. Do you find that when you've been making films, it is more a concern actually of emotions and feelings and aesthetics than maybe trying to nail down some kind of sense of reality? Because cinema is, by its nature, an artificial process, and therefore you might as well play to its strengths rather than try and make a newsreel.
Well, I do to an extent, but then I've spent a lot of time working with newsreels and finding ways of making them seem more like, you know, dreamt sequences than real sequences. I very much like the idea of blurring any kind of boundary between fictional work or so-called documentary work. I mean, it's all very much someone's point of view. And I think, you know, both those types of filmmaking are about storytelling, however you look at it. So, you know, I think the cinema is using reality instead of paint. You know, I mean, you are taking fragments of reality that you've left huge other chunks out of or excluded, and you're colliding them with other pieces. And in that sense, it's not unlike painting, but you're using reality itself to paint with, rather than paint in a funny way, you know.
Although conversely, it doesn't look like you use any CGI in your films. It's all done in camera.
Yeah, I prefer to do it in camera. I love the idea that it's watching a film is an optical illusion, and if you can create it as an optical event rather than, I mean, you know, I'm not against painting telegraph poles out if it's the perfect place to shoot this thing, but something's wrong. But I like effects when you don't notice them more than when you do. And I hate the idea of a totally CGI-generated cinema. I think cinema should be about life and about chance as much as anything. You know, the more films you make, the more important the ability to respond to chance becomes, you know, and that's one reason why I have difficulty, kind of the Hollywood way of making films gets rid of every aspect of chance, you know. Even on Absolute Beginners, I was horrified by, you know, these wonderful sets, and it would be the end of the day, this wonderful light, and the Teddy Boys would be hanging out in the bomb site over there doing things you would never think of telling them to do, but we were setting a shot up over there, and the camera crew wouldn't pan round to catch this fantastic thing. And that struck me as like, God, you know, that's not what cinema's about. It should be about, you know, finding things in the moment, you know, as much as anything else. Yeah. Which we did to an extent on The Eternity Man as well, which was nice. You know, that moment of that connection with the voice actually being recorded as they sang it in the streets was to me, you know, was exploring chance as well, because, you know, an ambulance might go by and that might be great, you know. Or, you know, as they say, I love the sound of his breath running up, climbing stairs as he's singing. You know, it just gives it another feel. I like things when they're not totally perfect as well, you know, and the chance, you know, chance can corrupt, you know, the perfection. That's the tendency is to try and attain perfection as you write it all out, and you know, the weather or the running out of time, all these things that can seem bad can actually be wonderful, you know. You would not have written them out, you know, because they're not perfect, you know.
And just thinking of the old footage that you incorporate into The Eternity Man, some of that was obviously filmed for the film, the fake sort of silent footage of the end of the pier crank machine. And then other bits where you're projecting on buildings, presumably is existing footage. Did you ever tempted to revisit your own films in that way? Because obviously The Filth and the Fury reuses old footage that you used in your first feature-length Sex Pistols documentary. If you could get the rights, would you be tempted to use some of your own films?
Even if I couldn't get the rights, yeah. I would. I have, in fact, without telling people. I think films shouldn't be locked away in the back room of a DVD shop with no one buying them and no one seeing them, or in the BBC vault. You know, they're just dead. Unless someone, you know, reuses them and shows them again, it's a worthless thing. You know, a film is there to be seen, and, you know, I think the whole process of editing tells you if you put one image together with another image, they both change, you know. The meaning of them is really impacted by each other, and that certainly applies with taking old footage and putting it in new contexts. And I think there's a kind of alchemy that can be achieved with old footage too. I mean, I've just been doing a film about Dr. Feelgood, which is quite a lot about Canby Island, but it's also about so I've been using a lot of British B movie, gangster movies, and finding ways of giving them other meanings and creating kind of strange little pathways through the kind of foreground film, which is about this band in the 70s, but you know, playing with their conception of themselves as these secondhand car dealing, smash and grab, you know, hoodlum, second rate, hard guys kind of thing that crashed into that late 60s hippie when everyone was wearing smocks and dresses and things. They had this vision of themselves as something completely radically different from that. But it, you know, tracing that back in the way that you would trace the blues that they played through the early 60s R&B to the blues men of the Chicago or whatever, you know, you can trace that visual attitudinal construct back through, you know, B gangster movies of Britain, which I've totally forgotten, you know, and are not necessarily in their entirety that great, but there are moments in them that are really enlightening and powerful, you know. So that, you know, that's fun to do that kind of thing. And, you know, and hopefully if you do that, then some people will say, oh, I wouldn't mind, you know, exploring that area and seeing the films again anyway, you know. So I don't think it's just taking from them, it's giving them some life as well, you know.
If you'd like more information about The Eternity Man and future screenings of the film, please visit my blog at www.panelborders.wordpress.com. And I'm ready for my close-up. We'll be back at the same time next week.